All right, welcome to
Oh,
Why Is
wait,
This
wait.
Good?
Sorry.
Sorry.
I need to start
Whoa,
recording
wait,
as
wait,
well.
wait.
I hadn't clicked the
Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, John, it's your turn. Tell us about your story.
I brought the story How to Be an Other Woman by Lori Moore. It's from her collection from the 80s, sometime in the 80s, Self Help, from which we already did a story years and years ago called How to Become a Writer. It was originally from this
Yes.
collection.
Awesome. I love that one.
Yeah. Whisper, don't go yet, as he glides out of your bed before sunrise, and you lie there on your back, cooling, naked between the sheets and smelling of musky, oniony sweat. Feel gray, like an abandoned locker room towel. Watch him as he again pulls on his pants, his sweater, his socks, and shoes. Reach out and hold his thigh as he leans over and kisses you quickly, telling you not to get up, that he'll lock the door when he leaves. In the smoky darkness, you see him smile weakly, guiltily, and attempt a false, jaunty wave from the doorway. Turn on your side toward the wall, so you don't have to watch the door close. You hear it thud nonetheless, the jangle of keys and snap of the bolt lock, the footsteps loud, then fading down the staircase, the clunk of the street door, then nothing, all his sounds blending with the city, his face passing namelessly uptown in a bus or a badly heated cab, the room, the whole building you live in, shuddering at the windows as a truck roars by the Queensboro Bridge. Wonder who you are.
Had you read this one before, or how'd you find it?
This is another one. Many of my recent ones have been, I was reading something else and it referred to a story and it talked about a story and I thought, oh, I should read that. And with that same thought, oh, I should read that, I thought, oh, I should bring it to the podcast. This was months ago. I don't even remember what it was.
Okay, when you came across it or whatever.
Yeah.
When you mentioned that we had read her other story on the podcast, I'm remembering like how similar now these two are.
Oh, yeah.
That they're both sort of instructive and like addressing the reader.
Yeah, it's from that collection, Self Help. And I think that's the collection. I forget the exact term she used. We talked about it in the other episode. It's many years ago. So I don't remember exactly what the phrase was, but it's something like she called it the second person mock imperative. I think the word mock was in there as like a, like the how-to manual kind of style that was popular at that time and still is popular. But that kind of like, here's the steps to do the thing. And so she put together this collection of stories. And I haven't read any of the other ones in it. How to Become a Writer, and then this one, How to Be an Other Woman, are in that vein of kind of like that self-help, but she calls it mock imperative because it's a story. It's not actually that, but it's put in that kind of style.
Right. On my copy, I printed the like second page of the book or whatever. So it's like self-help stories by Lori Moore. And then it has contents listed on like the copyright page.
Oh, I didn't look at that.
How to Be Another Woman, What is Seized, and The Kid's Guide to Divorce. I'm like, I want to read that one by
Yeah.
her. I bet that would be great. But yeah, now I'm realizing, just thinking about how we had read that one on the podcast, like how similar, like you said, they are. And I've not been the other woman, right? But like, I've definitely wanted to be a writer. So it's like, I remember just like reading that and really identifying with it just because it felt like it was for writers. But seeing this one, knowing that that's not necessarily what I'm identifying with, there's still so many things that make this feel like real and enjoyable, and like she's articulating something that we all like can read and say, yes, that's exactly how it feels.
Yeah.
It makes me think that there are probably a lot of people that read the How to Be a Writer story who aren't writers and who still get a kick out of it, you know?
Yeah.
Because if you're doing anything well, and if it feels like you do have a handle on it or you are the expert, then there's something about it that you can enjoy. It doesn't have to be like a universal experience, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, how to become a writer was basically like how to kind of dream for something and work toward it. Like as a young person, go to school and try to figure things out.
Yeah, and it was like tongue in cheek because it was about all of the ways that all of these steps didn't amount to what it is she hoped, right? All the
Yeah.
missteps.
And this one is basically how to have an unfulfilling relationship, right?
Yeah, and so to that point, like there's things that are obviously things that you can identify with. This woman in the story is the one that is hoping for more, right? So we've all been that person, whether or not you've been the other woman. It reminded me too. too. Like, we've read a few stories now about different affairs and things. And here it's like very clearly like that's almost all it is, right? They go to dinner and
Oh,
they
yeah.
hook up like repeatedly.
Although, like, that seemed like the appropriate number of cultural
Yeah.
things
We
before you
went to
sleep with
like
someone.
four museums and like three dinners, and we hadn't slept together yet. I was like, wow. I liked though that the twist here was basically that the woman that he's living with is not his wife.
Yeah, he's already separated with from his wife, and like she turns out to just be another other woman.
Yeah, so How to Be the Other Woman, our main character here, us, you, the reader, we're just one of several women that this man goes around and sees. And that feels like more devastating to her than being the special chosen other woman.
I mean, one of the great things about this story, I thought, was just those little emotional moments. And after she finds out about that, we get that scene of her, like, what leads to her breaking up with him, and like how that plays out is really emotional. But this other moment with her mother, I thought was just, it's highly emotional, but it's like, it's not spelled out as to what is happening, but you get the feeling anyway. So she tells her mom, she has this snarky way about her. So she doesn't like come out and say, "Hey, I'm sleeping with a married guy." She says something, and her mom's like, "Wait, are you having an affair with a married man?" And she's like, "What do you, don't put it that way." And her mom's like, "You know, you're asking for trouble." And it's like, "I know, it's not something you would do," she says. And then she looks up at you, her mouth trembling, pieces of her brown gray hair dangling in her salty eyes, pink silverware cream caking onto her hands because she's polishing the silver,
Oh, yeah.
onto her wedding ring. She stops, puts a spoon down, looks away, and then hopelessly back at you like a very young girl, and shaking her head, bursts into tears. And then scene break. There's no follow-up, like, "Obviously, my mom was very upset about blah, blah, blah." It's just you get the moment and you read it how you will.
Yeah, because that could be anything.
I really like that.
Yeah, there's only almost something more powerful about like a raw scene like that, that in your real life might not have like a follow-up or a conclusion, right? They might not
Yeah.
have the kind of relationship where the mom's going to explain why it was she was crying in that moment. So you're just left with that. Yeah, and it feels really real.
Yeah, that kind of unresolved displays. We talk about in fiction, like, you know, everything needs to serve the purposes of the story, and the story is about the character. And so we need character resolutions, we need arcs, and we need, like, so we feel a lot of times this encouragement to like spell things out and to like give our characters resolutions and stuff. But
Right.
the way sometimes emotions play out is they are just momentary, and you don't get those resolutions. And it's just like you move on the next day, right?
Right. And then even though you don't get the resolution, like it was powerful enough and it seems important enough to like include it in this telling, right?
Yeah, it's part of the story.
Yeah. And not just because they're directly talking about this, but like I imagine like this w is such a fraught time for this woman in her life that maybe if there was an unrelated conversation that she had with her mother and her mother cried for some seemingly unrelated reason, it might still make it into the story because it would have been like of a time in her life where it felt like significant, you know? Because we really don't know why the mom's crying. They're talking about the affair directly, sure, but like.
Yeah. And it's like she says, what leads into it is she says, "It's not something you would do."
Right.
So you can kind of guess, like, she's either feeling bad because she did do something like this, or she's
Right.
realizing her daughter is her own person and not the kind of person she wanted to raise. There's like all kinds of ways you could understand that.
Right.
But all of them come up with some kind of disappointment, which is the whole theme of the story, right? Is some kind of
Yeah.
disappointment.
Like the mom could have been another woman. She could have been cheated on by another woman.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And the daughter's just like you said, she's got a certain like way about her. Like she's a little snarky that she's not engaging at that level with her mom. These aren't like scenes necessarily, but I just love Lori Moore here. So she's got like two
Some
lines
great
like on
lines.
yeah, like page six, she's like describing what it at first feels like to be a mistress. And there's like two lines at the end of this like little section. It says, "It is like having a book out from the library. It is like constantly having a book out from the library."
Yeah.
And then my favorite like passage was on page 17, where she's talking about how there's nights when he promises that he'll try to make it over. He's like, he's gonna try, but there's no no guarantee. And so she spends all the time getting ready, and then she like lays in bed completely done up and her house unlocked, like hoping that he might stop by. And then when he finds her, she'll have mascara and jewelry on and like just look like great. And then she's describing like this like as this habitual thing that happens, but then she's essentially like sitting in the bed having one of these nights, and she says, "Remember, at Blakely Falls High, Willis Holmes would have done anything to be with you. You don't have to put up with this. You were second runner-up at the junior prom." And there's something like really like it sounds funny, right? To be second runner-up at the junior prom, like this isn't some like big win, but I like that what she's capturing there is essentially like this feeling that she was a prize then. She knew she was a prize then, and there were men that wanted to be with her just to be with her. And maybe that was the most recent time where she felt like she deserved that or something. So it's like it's sad because maybe that's the last time she felt like she deserved that was when she was what, 16?
It's a thing she can now reach back to and be like, I do have worth because at one time.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, look how far you've fallen. Now you're laying in bed waiting for a married man that hasn't shown up.
Yeah, she's got to find something to reassure herself. And that's the thing she can reach for.
But it's like a little self-deprecating too, because even if she feels like, you know, she's still laying in bed waiting for this motherfucker.
I mean, Laurie Moore is a really good writer. I love the so many of her words. She does puns, and it's in the voice of the it's interesting because it's in second person, that second person imperative, like whose voice is it? But it feels like the character's voice, because even when the character like talks to her mom and or talks to the dude, I can't think of his name,
I don't even know.
but whenever she even speaks, she has this same kind of voice to her, like this kind of playful punny kind of thing. But a lot of that feels like it's also Laurie Moore. But she has this description that I marked at Karmacola, which I think is that the company she's working at. At Karmacola, the days are peg-legged and aimless, collapsing into one another with a comic tedium of old clowns, nowhere fast. It's like, what a spectacular description. Peg-legged and aimless. It's like a stumbling kind of gait, that like the a way to move through the world. And you're describing days at a company, days at work. This is a kind of like those little moments are what we want to think about for when we're writing, is like of capturing that kind of imagery and like really stunning connections between ideas. Like it's a feeling that you can capture by bringing disparate things together and expressing them.
I was trying to find his name after you said that. I don't know that we know his name, but there's one point where her coworker is talking to her and she addresses her. She's like, "I'm happy for you, Charlene." So apparently her name's Charlene, but this is
Yeah,
coming like
he
two
calls her
thirds in.
Charlene a couple times too.
And it doesn't even register. So like to your point about like this being like second person and like who's talking, and I don't know, I feel like I talk about second person all the time and I'm always getting it wrong. But like it's not just talking to you, the reader. She's not addressing you, she's talking to herself.
We've been talking about this the
I
whole time as
know.
like she, this character, like we're talking about her in the third person, even though we've been reading it in the second person. So I think there's something to that idea. Like it doesn't matter what you write it in. You write it in first person, second person, third person. When we conceptualize the story, we conceptualize it as a character who's different from us. Doesn't matter how it's addressed. It's just an interesting way of presenting it.
And I do think there's examples of like second person that we have read on the podcast that are more like distant from a character. So I'm thinking of like gator butchering for beginners. So she's talking about like butchering a gator and going through a breakup, but the specifics are so sort of like vague that you can read them as a series of instructions to the reader themselves, you know? And this gets like so specific that it's like, and we even have a name. You know what I mean? There's not a name in that other one. I think there's ways to do it where it's like there's a range of like who you're speaking to, but you still sort of know that it's about a character. It's just this is like so concrete.
I mean, there are, I don't think I need to go into that on the podcast. There are conceptual reasons, like the way our minds conceptualize things, to think that no matter what you do, we use the same mental processes to understand other people as we do to understand ourselves. So just like it's a mash when it gets into your head. So it doesn't matter. Your brain just tags it as other in some way. I want to talk about the second person of it all. This is going to be part of my takeaway, but it's going to be a lot. And I'm going to talk about
I'm ready.
grammar.
I'm ready. I won't understand it, but I'm ready to try.
So I was thinking about this as I'm reading this, because we have a lot of the kind of description of what's happening. It's in, or is primarily in, what I already mentioned she called the mock imperative or something like that. So it's in the imperative mood. So she has a lot of these, like in the first paragraph, it's like meet in expensive beige raincoats on a pea soupy night, like a detective movie. First, stand, that's an imperative verb, in front of Florsheim's 57th Street window. Press your face close to the grass. Watch the fake velvet hummels inside revolving around the wingtips. And then this line is, some white shoes, like your father wears, are propped up with garlands on a small mound of chemical snow. That's not imperative, that's more indicative. All stores have closed. And this one, you can see your breath on the glass. And then again to the imperative, draw a peace sign, and back to indicative, you are waiting for a bus. So there's this like kind of, it goes back and forth throughout the thing where there's imperative clauses or imperative verbs, which are like
right.
commands, directives.
Yeah.
And there are indicative ones, which is just like, this is what the world is like. And we talk about the difference between tense, you know, what time period things, past, present, future, and aspect is like whether or not it's a completed action or an incomplete action that is ongoing or continuous. But then mood is a totally different thing for verbs. It's like how real is the thing? Like subjunctive mood is hypothetical. Like if I were to be an astronaut,
okay,
I would do this. And like that would in there indicates hypothetical.
Yeah. Okay.
And even the were is disappearing as a subjunctive marker in English. But if I were is kind of the old style of saying it. Nowadays, we just say if I was.
Yeah, right.
But in both cases, there's still in the if, and it's indicating it's a hypothetical. And imperative is like that. It's not something that's happened. It's something we want to happen. It's something that's directed. We're directing it to happen. We're kind of telling someone to do that. They can choose not to do it. So a lot of this is in that mood of the imperative mood of like directives. And then it switches over to the indicative of like things that are, like a lot of descriptions are. And like as I'm reading, like it feels like a lot of the characters kind of decision points are done in the imperative. So you'll have like a description of what's going on. It's like when the character takes a specific action, it's often in that.
I see one where it's like, can I take your coat? And it says, be strange and awkward.
Yeah, something like that's imperative. Like be, because if it were indicative, it would just be are, is. A lot of what is said is prefaced with say, colon,
yeah,
and then the quote. But then like odd things is like the moment she chooses to sleep with him, it's after 4 movies, 3 concerts, and 2.5 museums, you sleep with him, which is not after 4 movies, 3 concerts, 2.5 museums, sleep with him.
Right.
It's not imperative for that one. And that's a decision point, right?
Right.
That's a specific action or a concrete action, I guess. But there's even later on, like it's talking about how imperative is kind of is a mood of things that aren't actual. They're like directed, but not necessarily carried out. But there's a hypothetical marker later on, it's on page 11. They have been to an expensive college, say, in Massachusetts. That say is kind of like is another way to introduce hypothetical things. Like you would say, let's say we're going to the restaurant and this happens.
Sure.
So there's a kind of an interesting play with what is real and what is hypothetical in this story, as far as the way that that marker, the imperative, is working in the story. And when she chooses, Laurie Moore chooses to use imperative versus indicative for describing things, is probably, you could probably dig into like really work it out. Like my instinct was just like decision points, but it's probably not merely that. I do think that one of the cool things that you can do with imperative is most of these sentences, just the way English works, have to start with the imperative verb. You get like a descriptive clause, like when morning comes, go downstairs, right?
Okay.
So the go is the verb, but you get a kind of like introductory clause to set the scene. But sentences have to be like built around like a very strong like central verb, and that comes first in the imperative mood in this way. It's not like she goes downstairs. It's always go downstairs.
Right.
But then you get to do things like, she writes, he kisses you almost gratefully on the ear, fidget, twitch, lie, say, I mean, yes. So you get 4 verbs in a row with nothing else in those sentences, because those are each complete imperative sentences.
Right.
You would get, she fidgets, she twitches. You could probably phrase it in a flowery, like in an interesting way, where she fidgets, twitches,
yeah,
and she lies and says. But just to have those single verbs, like it's like
right,
a forceful list like that, that each kind of like are describing the scene. You can get that because it's in the imperative. Anyway, that was the stuff I was thinking about as I'm reading it, is just how the imperative mood is used and how indicative mood is used, and how that kind of like, whether it's real or not real, kind of contrasts as you're moving through it. And because it's written in this self-help style,
yeah,
we're not going to think of these things as being unreal. We're going to assume the character is doing each of these things. But that is what the mood of the verb or the modality of the verb indicates, is that it's not necessarily something that has happened. So it's like an exercise to like think think about those distinctions.
Is that your takeaway then? The idea that.
My takeaway is when I'm writing sentences in general, even if it's ordinary third person past
Right.
tense, like simple narrative, to think about those issues that this raises as to how I'm presenting things. You think about Bullet in the Brain and how so many of those descriptions were, he didn't think about this. He didn't think about this.
Right, right,
It's like
right.
negations. And that's, you're not describing something that is, you're describing something that's not. And in this, it's, you're describing things that are hypothetical or things that are desired or directed, not necessarily things that are real. So those are the directions prose can take you as to these different ways of understanding the world around us is not necessarily merely what is in front of us and in the scene, but also what you can contemplate outside of it as a character or as a narrator or as a reader.
Yeah, I think the bullet in the brain is a good example of that because, like you said, it's listing things that he's not actually thinking about.
This is such an esoteric, abstruse takeaway. I recognize that.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things where I don't know that I could apply it as I'm writing. I'd have to write my story and then think about this lesson and be like, what am I implying here? Is this actually happening on the page? Have I taken a reader out of it?
I kind of want to reread How to Become a Writer with that in mind.
Sure.
Even the gator butchering or the chicken wing stories and stuff like that, just to see how those handle it. Because there is a distinction when you move from imperative to indicative, it reads differently, in my mind at least. They do have different kind of like feelings about them. And I would be curious to know how Lori Moore thought about it as she was composing it. Like, was it just a feeling thing? Like, this verb needs to be in this command style, and this one needs to be just a descriptive style. I don't know.
Yeah, it almost feels like a choose your own adventure type book where no matter how many times you say you want to go to the crypt, like you're still going to end up in the swamp, you know? And it's because like Laurie Moore still has to decide that like you will sleep with him, right?
Yes. Yeah. To go to the crypt, turn to page three. Page three. On the way to the crypt, you stumble into the swamp.
Yeah, and you're like, God
No,
damn it. No,
that's
that's
not
not
what
what
I
I want
was
to
doing.
do. But it's like, no, I'm pointing you toward this part of the story. And there maybe there's like, if she's not doing it consciously, choosing between the two, maybe there's points in the story where things happen that are outside of this character's control, which is why they're not imperative.
Yeah, like everything he does in the
Yeah.
story is just ordinary indicative. He says this, he
Or even like you
picks
sleep with
this up.
him. It's like you like allow that to happen. He
That's
decides
true.
that's going to happen then.
That's right, because that's
That
not
part
an
of the story is
imperative.
not your choice. I kind of feel like I think Lori Moore would maybe listen to your description of her writing and be like, yeah, interesting. But I don't know. She just seems like she can write this so deftly that she doesn't need to think about the decisions. You know what I mean? I would argue it's a natural thing that's just happening. Yeah.
Well, she speaks English, right? And any speaker of English who,
Yeah.
like, we just have this, like, kind of sense of what the imperative mood does and the sense of what the indicative mood does. We don't need to describe it. We don't read grammar books to learn how to use the language. We just use it. And, like, the grammar books are there to describe how people use the language. They're not there to tell you how to use the language. It's like, usually when people use imperative, this is what they seem to mean. So she doesn't need to, like, dig into it to understand what she's doing. She just feels
Right.
it. And I think that's true of when we write anything, like whether you're going to use even tense, whether you use present tense or past tense, it's like, what does it feel like? It feels more, I hate to say immediate because both past and present feel immediate,
Yeah.
but there's something that happens when you use present and something that happens when you use past that kind of like gives you a sense of, oh, I want this story to be in the present tense or whatever it is. And the same thing with like verb aspect, like whether it's a continuous verb, perfective or imperfective, or it's like, I need to describe this action as ongoing so that I can interrupt it in the next sentence. So you use the imperfective. You don't think that through. You don't think, he needs to be in the middle of walking. So I need to describe him as he was walking so
Right.
that the truck can hit him.
Right. Yeah, no, it just happens naturally.
Yeah.
I was going to jump to my takeaway because I was trying to think of one and then I came up with one.
There's no follow-up to what I was saying, so.
You're like, well, we're done with this. It's fine. Well, the other thing about like past tense and present tense, though, is like present is obviously like more immediate, but there's something about like something written in present tense that feels like anything could happen. Like the story's in progress as you read it. Like the pages are coming as you flip versus like in past tense, this is over, you know? Like it's all here, it's all finished. You're not an active participant.
Yeah, like your favorite kind of retrospective narrative is
Yeah.
That's a past tense feeling kind
Yeah.
of thing, right?
Yeah. And I love those, but yeah, I hate present tense. But anyway, I think my takeaway, I'm realizing that there's a lot of lines in here that I like that I think are like pretty important to the overall feel of the story. Like the one I read earlier where she says, it feels like borrowing a book from the library. It feels like constantly like borrowing a book from the library. I think I just butchered that. But there's lines like that that are like these descriptive sort of like metaphors and similes and all that shit. And they're
Like
good
the
and they're
one I
powerful.
read about the peg leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I would argue that the peg leg one is kind of a good example of what it is I'm pointing out here, where it's like, is it totally necessary? No. Like, I think the library book one is a pretty good one because we're talking directly about the affair. The peg leg one, she's talking about like the monotony of her work or what it's like to work at that job. And maybe that's a little less important, or maybe it's a little bit of a stretch. And I was like skimming this as we were talking, and there's the scene where she finally spends the night at his house where she sees the other woman's belongings,
Yeah.
and she's like in the closet. She finds all of her shoes in the closet. Inside the caves of those shoes, eyes form and open their lids, stare up at you, regard you, wink at you from the insoles. They're half friendly, conspiratorial, amused at the reconnaissance of yours, like little smiling men from the open hatches of a fleet of military submarines. Turn off the light and shut the door quickly before they start talking or dancing or something. Scurry back to the bed and hide your face in his armpit. Like, wow, we just went on a little bit of a journey there where, unless you really like that style or you find this Charlene character like endearing, that could be just like it's unnecessary, right? But there's something about it where you're just delighting in the imagery, right? It's completely unnecessary to describe the shoes this much. All she needs to do is look at the shoes and we could say something like really just blatant, like it's so strange to see another woman's shoes. I didn't know she liked those kind of wedges, right? Whatever. But there's something about this where she's like, I don't know, and maybe it speaks to like the fact that she's really like going through it because it's in the next scenes that you read where she's like, every woman is her, and oh, look at her, and look at this nose, and look at those shoes. But I'm just appreciating this as a writer and as a reader, like just picturing it. It's just fun.
Yeah, they're like they become a totem, and so they need to be personified in some way. So giving them faces is a way to do that because they have more power over her than merely the thought in the moment.
Right.
Or this is what doing that accomplishes. It gives them more power, and then that kind of like gets to be carried through the rest of the story. Like that's why she's obsessing over shoes after that, is because she had that experience. And if Laurie Moore didn't take the moment to like do that with the description of the shoes, we might be like, why is she obsessing over shoes? Because we don't have that thing to remember. Because we didn't, as we were reading, also obsess over shoes.
Right.
You know, reading is a vicarious experience. You get to experience things as a character does because of the way that the story is played out. So the longer this prose lingers on something, the longer you linger on something, and then it becomes salient to you. And that salience is affected directly by how well it is brought to life. And that kind of passage really brings the shoes to life in an emotional way.
Right. Or like she's describing like the utensils hanging in his kitchen. Like there's something about she describes him as a small army of chrome utensils hanging belligerent and clean as blades on the wall. Like there's just something ominous about everything that belongs to
Yeah.
this other woman. And like we don't need those descriptions, but like you said, once she points them out, then we experience them the way she's experiencing them. And it's everything is just
One that
unnerving.
jumped out at me just from memory, I don't know if I could find it, but it was she looked down the throat of the toilet.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man.
I guess my takeaway being that, like, a lot of times we talk about details and stories needing to, like, be ones that matter overall. And if I wanted to, I could maybe decide that we needed to cut some of this stuff. I wouldn't. There's nothing here that feels like extra as I'm reading, but
You got to make them matter, right?
yeah, they all feel like they matter either, like, directly for, like, this overall feel or the plot itself or for understanding the characters. And they also just develop the character a little bit, right? Like, we're understanding Charlene for the ways that she describes her own feelings. And, you know, it feels like we're sitting down to lunch with her and she's like, oh my God, I opened the closet and I looked at these women's shoes and I just, oh, it was, you know, however she would describe it, maybe not like this literary, but it feels like we're getting to know her through these descriptions. But I guess I would just say, like, I think every once in a while, if you do have a clever way to describe something that feels like completely innocuous in your story, like, go ahead and do it. Because every once in a while,
Yeah.
you can like land on something that just sounds beautiful. It sounds great. And you don't need to describe it at all. But if you do it the right way, then like I'm into it. And maybe
Yeah.
the key here is like that they are metaphors almost, or they are similes, like things lined up like this, or shining like that, or whatever it is. Maybe that's how you kind of get away with it versus when we talk about unnecessary details that end up feeling like red herrings to a reader.
They capture an emotion is
Yeah.
what part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like if you lean into into just thinking about it being a literary description. Like you're a poet in that moment and you want to describe something as looking or feeling a certain way. You're probably allowed to do that. Because I think the danger, though, that we try to tell people to avoid is like, don't tell us that this girl's coat is red unless it matters.
Yeah.
Don't just say it's red because we're going to be thinking, okay, clocked it. Now what? But if you say it's like, it's red, like a, I don't know, like a soldier's blah, blah, blah suit, then maybe we know something about the way the character is wearing her clothing, how she presents in the world or whatever.
I think the key there is like you're trying to evoke an emotion with the description, but whose emotion are you trying to evoke? As long as that emotion is attached to the character, then it's not out of place. Then it works because that character is experiencing that emotion and you're trying to impart that emotion onto the reader through this description at the same time that they're experiencing it. So the shoes thing, she was having a moment with those shoes. And so Laurie Moore describes the shoes so that we can have that moment with her. The silverware hanging up like blades, like that's an emotion. She's like scared, but it's a passing thing. She just kind of glances over him. So it's not as detailed and deep as the shoes thing, but it still has that emotion.
So I don't know. I don't feel like we often, at least like I'm thinking like recently in terms of like what I've seen come across in like workshops and things, like I don't feel like I see this kind of like aside where somebody just like takes the liberty to pause for a moment on something like that could otherwise be nondescript or like not really pertinent to the story. But like you're saying, like there's a key to doing it. And if it illuminates something about this character, like captures an emotion, not only is it worth it, but it could be like necessary that way, right? Like then we're understanding how this character's moving through the world. And so maybe the lesson too is like not just that you've earned these phrases, but that you should stop and pause and think, like, how is this character perceiving their world and how is that important to my story or the scene?
I think you can get that in the same. I'm thinking of that Annie Proust story, Brokeback Mountain. And there was another story where the people were living out in the woods, but we were talking about like capturing like nature, the land. Like, I feel like that's the same thing you can do. Like, the land itself has an emotion. So if you're going to describe it, be in that emotion as you're describing it.
And then like on the flip side, a description of weather or scenery that feels pointless would be something that doesn't capture that emotion and be like, the grass was green, it was really pretty, and inside the character was sad. It's like unless the point is like this massive juxtaposition, then like you've missed the mark for that description.
It was a dark and stormy night. Works if the character is dark and stormy, right? Once upon a midnight dreary.
Yeah, maybe that's a good way to think of it. It's like, would I want to read about this description of the kitchen if it was setting? Probably not. But like, would I if it like directly relates to the character? Then yeah, it's not just weather. It's not just, I'm trying to think what else we should point out for this one. I guess I really enjoyed it. It reminded me of so many stories in terms of plot and everything, but also just like the tone. And I like that this is potentially like a really sad, depressing story where this woman is just like, what am I doing with my life? But she seems to like maintain like a sort of like levity about it. She's like self-reflective. She hasn't completely lost herself in it. And she says something about this having gone on for something like 3 months. It's not like it's years or something. And then she kind of, gets out of it.
Yeah, I don't know if we should talk about this. But I don't know if how pertinent it is, but that we kind of mentioned that like she realizes he already has an other woman. He's living with somebody else who's not his wife. And that's what makes her break up with him. Because she's like, wait, I thought what we had was special. I was the other woman, but I'm not. I'm just some other woman.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. And then, like, she says, like, it says, love drains from you, takes with it much of your blood, sugar, and water weight. You are like a house slowly losing its electricity, the fans slowing, the lights dimming and flickering, the clocks stop and go and stop. Like, what a great little description there. And then she's just over it. So I like it because it just feels like it captures what it is to be the other woman, but not in this, like, super plot heavy, like, and then this goes on for years, and then you break up with your boyfriend, and he leaves his wife, but the kids find it just captures this feeling and this, like, sort of moment of this realization. And yeah, it's just great.
You know, one thing that we could point out is it is in the second person, the self-help imperative. And a lot of like a real self-help book would try to generalize things, try to be like, this is what you should do in a very generic situation. Your situation will be slightly different, but let me talk about the generic situation. And because she's writing fiction, because she's trying to capture emotions and like the kind of things that real human beings deal with, it has to be very specific.
Really specific,
It can't just be like, in general, this is how being an other woman would be.
Yeah, because then it goes back to like the gator butchering for beginners, where it's like that could be self-help or whatever in that second person, but you can only do it for so long before like you really need the specifics of like a character.
Yeah, there we go.
There we go. All right. Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/NaplesWritersWorkshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.